but it'll make it easier for the veteran to stay within the healthcare network that they want to be in.
Veterans hope for real change within the VA health system. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, June 16th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, elders in Bethel lament the impending loss of the senior center.
I'm just talking to my friends, people here. Even if I can't see or hear, they come to me.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. Mount Edgecombe High School provides a curriculum rich in culture and diversity, offering over 80 courses from art to advanced engineering and with activities from native dance to kayaking. Class sizes are no larger than 30. Explore your talents and develop your dreams. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
Former Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan is dropping out of the race for U.S. Senate. He made the announcement just 15 days after he filed to challenge Lisa Murkowski in the Republican primary. In a press release, Sullivan says conservative leaders, who he did not name, asked him to run just one day before the filing deadline. He says there's significant financial support for a conservative candidate, but he says it would be best for him to work on other political issues. The ex-mayor's withdrawal leaves Senator Murkowski with three Republican challengers, Paul Kendall, Thomas Lamb, and Bob Lochner. They are all running shoestring campaigns, while Murkowski has raised $5.7 million. U.S. Senator Murkowski, through her assignment on the Appropriations Committee, is charged with writing a bill that funds a wide swath of the federal government. It's a major opportunity to direct money to agencies important to Alaska. But as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, Murkowski's bill is off to a rocky start.
Murkowski, in a phone call with reporters, ticked off the agency her bill funds.
BLM, Forest Service, EPA, Fish and Wildlife, IHS, BIA, Park Service.
So this is big for Alaska. Murkowski says she wrote it to fully fund programs like payment in lieu of taxes, which sends money to local governments in Alaska, and contract support costs for Native organizations that perform government services. Her bill also adds money for earthquake monitoring, high-tech mapping, and cleaning up old wells the government drilled in the Arctic. Murkowski says she intends for the bill to provide stability to help Alaska through its fiscal crisis.
What we're trying to do is direct federal resources where they're needed.
A funding bill is also an opportunity to add policy riders that have little to do with appropriating money. Murkowski included a dozen riders. One directs the Forest Service to keep offering timber sales as it has in the Tongass National Forest. Another orders a land trade to build a road for King Cove. The most sweeping of her riders would block a controversial EPA rule redefining which waters are subject to federal regulation. Dick Durbin of Illinois, the Senate's second highest-ranking Democrat, told Murkowski she went too far.
I think you may have reached a tipping point here with these 12 riders that you put in here. I believe that it's quite likely this bill will never be considered on the floor because of these riders.
Murkowski says half of the 12 riders Democrats are calling poison pills were actually requested by Democrats. And she says she took plenty of heat from Republicans for including them. The Appropriations Committee passed her bill, but it was 16-14, with all the Democrats voting no. There are enough Democrats in the full Senate to kill just about any important bill. Murkowski told reporters she's not giving up.
It's fully my intention to keep working with individuals. The concerns that were raised.
Hers is one of a dozen appropriations bills Congress is supposed to pass each year. Usually, though, some or all of them get rolled into a giant spending package called an omnibus that lawmakers have to pass to avoid a government shutdown. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A major change is coming in the way Alaska veterans get medical care. Congressional leaders announced Monday that TriWest, the subcontractor acting as an intermediary between veterans and medical providers, will no longer be responsible for booking appointments. Veterans in Alaska have criticized the appointment process as a major bottleneck in accessing critical care. As Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, many see the change as a small potential improvement within a larger web of problems connected to the 2014 Choice Act.
Retired Army Sergeant Zach Sherman lives in Fairbanks, and last fall he tried to make an appointment through the VA for help with worsening health issues connected to post-traumatic stress that began with his deployments in Iraq.
So I called in October saying, you know, I really need some help. I'm in a lot of pain, and I'm really depressed, and I'm having anxiety issues, and I'm non-functional, and I need your assistance.
Weeks later, Sherman was sent to a local clinic. The experience was demoralizing. He says it wasn't a good practice, and at the end, he was left without a real diagnosis, just referrals for more tests elsewhere. When he tried to arrange those follow-ups, the real nightmare began.
So I had to call TriWest. Then TriWest had to go, well, we don't have the authorization. So I had to call the doctor to force the doctor to give...
Until about a year ago, it was the VA that handled making follow-up appointments like this. They knew nearby providers and understood the circumstances for local vets. Now, Sherman found himself calling TriWest and driving back and forth to get referrals in order to finally get an X-ray at an imaging clinic.
Call a month later to say, why has no one called me about my X-rays, to have them tell me, oh, well, we didn't see anything, so we didn't bother calling you.
It was frustrating, time-consuming, and there were mistakes. Sherman would be routed to a TriWest call center in Hawaii, where employees would direct him to medical options hundreds of miles away, or book appointments with doctors who didn't actually accept VA coverage. Describing TriWest's performance with booking appointments, Sherman, who is a former infantryman, doesn't mince words.
I think that a show may be a compliment to them.
The news that starting next month, the VA will once again handle booking medical appointments for vets might sound small, but for those working closely on the problem, it's pretty significant.
I think it's a major change, actually.
Verdi Bowen directs the state's Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, which connects veterans in Alaska with VA resources. Sitting in his office in Anchorage, Bowen says one of the problems over the last year has been that TriWest didn't actually have staff in Alaska to understand the nuances of the state's healthcare system. That's improved since the company moved six staffers to the state earlier this year. And now that local VA employees are the ones booking appointments, Bowen thinks the process will be even more effective.
It'll make it easier for the veteran to stay within the healthcare network that they want to be in. That's number one. And number two, it'll also help that if the veteran does not want to go to that doctor or to that service, they'll be able to talk to someone directly, one-on-one, and be able to fix those issues right up front.
TriWest isn't going away. They'll still handle billing medical providers, which Bowen at DMVA says they actually do faster than the VA. He described the new arrangement as the best of both worlds. It's unclear what the change means for tax dollars paid to TriWest. The company is compensated based on completed appointments. It featured prominently in a recent investigation by National Public Radio into larger problems ushered in by the 2014 Choice Act passed by Congress. TriWest declined a request for an interview, but in an email, spokesperson Elaine Labitz wrote, "When pieces to the process are eliminated or revised, payment is appropriately recalibrated." Sherman isn't too optimistic. He's lost six friends that he served with to suicide in the last 2.5 years, and thinks that while changes to the appointment process will help vets connect with care, it's a relatively modest adjustment to a confusing bureaucratic process.
You know, I'm pretty high functioning and have a good support network. If I didn't, I probably wouldn't be here.
The Alaska VA resumes control of appointments starting July 10th. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaskans' permanent fund dividends would still be cut, but not as much, under a new version of a bill to restructure fund earnings. The House Finance Committee introduced the bill this afternoon. Dividend checks would drop by about $500 instead of the $1,000 cut included in the Senate's version of the bill. After 2 years, the dividend would depend on the price of oil. the PFD could rise to as much as $2,000 again if oil prices reach $130 per barrel. Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra plans to vote for the bill.
I understand those people who have a hard time voting for this, given that that so much is still being paid to oil companies and corporate subsidies. On the other hand, I have a fear that every one of these bills that we see in the future is just going to get worse. But a main feature is that the dividend has a chance to grow much larger than all of the prior versions of this bill.
In addition, the new bill lessens the impact of a limit to combined state revenue from earnings and the oil and gas industry. In years with high oil revenue, more money could be spent on the state budget. As a result of the changes, the bill would draw less money from permanent fund earnings to reduce the state's deficit. Some House members say the changes make the bill worse. North Pole Republican Tammy Wilson says any cut to PFDs should be put to a referendum.
Without a vote of the people, it's never the right time. We need to go out and we need to ask them. They need to participate in this discussion, and then we need to follow their will.
Governor Bill Walker has called the bill the centerpiece to his plan to make the state budget more sustainable. It's not clear whether the bill will have enough votes to pass the full House, and it may face a higher hurdle in the Senate. Dr. Michael Johnson will be the new Commissioner of Education and Early Development. In a state release today, Governor Walker said he was pleased to have Dr. Johnson begin his new appointment on July 1st. Johnson most recently served as superintendent for the Copper River School District. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the mystery of metal from Asia making its way to Alaska.
How did something get manufactured perhaps in Manchuria or Korea, and how long did it take to make its way to Alaska?
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com, and by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
More than a dozen former military leaders jumped into a fight over offshore drilling in the Arctic yesterday, asking the Department of Interior to allow lease sales in Alaska's Arctic. The deadline is tonight for groups to weigh in on the Interior Department's plan. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney reports.
The military leaders say the U.S. is lagging behind other nations and could lose its economic and political foothold in the resource-rich region without new investments. General Joseph Ralston, formerly of the U.S. Alaskan Command, joined 15 other veterans and a former Secretary of Defense asking for the Arctic leases to be kept in the plan. It covers the next 5 years.
The idea that we would somehow take leasing of the Chukchi and the Beaufort Sea off the table while Russia is investing heavily, while Norway is drilling, while Canada will be drilling, just does not make sense from a national security perspective.
The Interior Department has gotten deluged with comments. Nearly 200,000 have been logged since the agency first requested them in mid-March. Some industry and pro-exploration groups fear the administration might drop the Arctic from its leasing plan. The agency is already proposing to drop similar lease sales in the Atlantic. Michael Levine is the Pacific Senior Counsel for Oceana, an ocean conservation organization based in Juneau. He says private companies shouldn't be responsible for the nation's geopolitical ambitions.
Certainly all of us in Alaska and in the environmental community are sensitive to the needs of national security and a sustainable energy future. If, however, we are depending on Shell and other companies for national security, we're all in trouble.
In the past 6 months, several companies, including Shell, have abandoned the leases they already hold in the region. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rasha McChesney in Juneau.
There's new evidence that metal goods from Central Asia made their way to Alaska long before contact with Europeans. That's according to a study published this month in the Journal of Archaeological Science. But as KNOM's Emily Russell reports, there's still a lot of unknown about one artifact in particular.
The buckle is about 3 centimeters in length and maybe 2 to 3 centimeters wide.
That's Corey Cooper, an archaeologist at Purdue University and one of the authors of the study. He's been working for the past few years with Owen Mason, who was there when the buckle was discovered.
And near the end of the season, as it always is, one of our excavators came across this metal object.
Mason spends almost every summer at Cape Espenberg in northwest Alaska, one of the oldest inhabited settlements in North America. Mason's team, also led by archaeologist John Hoffecker, has found a handful of other metal artifacts over the years, but Mason says he knew right away the buckle was unique.
Cast bronze, you know, which is a very elaborate type of technology, had really never been seen before. So immediately, this piece stood out.
To cast or to mold metal requires really high temperatures. And Mason says there's never been any evidence of that in Alaska's prehistoric settlements. To be sure, though, Mason sent the buckle down to Corey Cooper's lab in Indiana, where Cooper used X-ray technology to confirm traces of tin and lead in the buckle.
So this is the first time that anybody's found this kind of object that is definitely something that was made by metal-producing cultures, most likely somewhere in Eurasia.
Cooper was also able to confirm the buckle dates back to at least 800 AD, when Cape Espenberg was still a village. But Owen Mason says a lot of questions remain unanswered.
You know, there's still a lot of mystery here. How did something get manufactured, perhaps, in Manchuria or Korea? And how long did it take to make its way to Alaska?
Mason and his colleagues are still working on those answers. Their efforts are part of a larger project funded by the National Science Foundation's Office of Polar Programs. Mason says archaeological work at ancient sites like Cape Espenberg are now more urgent than ever.
With the thawing of permafrost, with global change, with climate change, you know, the sites are being subject to thawing and degradation.
Mason is on his way back up to Cape Espenberg for what he hopes will be another groundbreaking season in the field. Reporting in Nome, I'm Emily Russell.
There were 9 new wildfires reported in Alaska yesterday, including 6 on a machine gun training range on Fort Wainwright in Fairbanks. The range fires each burned well less than an acre before being put out by military personnel. Alaska Fire Service spokeswoman Beth Epson says the Army works with the agency to minimize wildfire risk.
There's a pretty strict process and protocol that military members, USARAC has to go through in order to conduct the training. So, you know, we're pretty well aware of what's going on. And there's actually weekly meetings between the military and military's own Alaska Fire Service personnel. And there's also people on site in case there is a fire, they can jump on it quickly and put it out, just like what they did yesterday.
2 of the other new wildfires reported in the state yesterday were on St. Lawrence Island in the Bering Sea. The Alaska Interagency Coordination Center report says a 100-acre blaze was started along a trail by an all-terrain vehicle muffler. Residents of the island village of Savunga put out the fire. The other fire, a less than 1-acre blaze, was also human-caused. The Copper River King Salmon Run is coming in weaker than anticipated. Alaska Department of Fish and Game Glen Allen Area Management Biologist Mark Somerville says run measures, including a weak commercial king harvest on the Delta and subpar in-river counts and catches, all point to the same thing.
We're looking at some of the lowest projections for this time, below the escapement goal of 24,000 fish into the river.
Despite a slight uptick last year, Somerville says Copper River King returns have been generally depressed since 2009, and this year's run was already forecast to be another weak one. Various measures have been enacted to protect kings, both in the commercial harvest on the Delta and in river. Somerville says sport fishing for kings will be limited to catch and release above the Clutina River as of June 18th, and a seasonal bag limit in the Chitna dipnet fishery is being reduced from 1 king to 0.
Closed for retention king salmon in the Perseus fishery beginning next Monday on the 20th.
Somerville says additional fishing restrictions could follow depending on how the rest of the King return comes in, noting that subsistence harvest has priority and will be the last fishery affected. The much larger Copper River sockeye return is also tracking weaker than forecast, but still well within the historic range.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Business Administration Program at Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive education grounded in real-world experience with life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. Move forward with APU and apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Alaska State Troopers say the three men killed Tuesday in a traffic crash on a remote Aleutian Island were all from Anchorage. Troopers say 43-year-old Ray McCullough Jr., 51-year-old Mike Tunahoon Jr., and 57-year-old Paul Nicholas Nesbitt died in the single-vehicle crash of a passenger van in the village of Atka. Atka is a fishing village of 68 people located 1,200 miles southwest of Anchorage and 350 miles west of Unalaska. Investigators have not been able to reach Atka because of poor weather. A driver and nine passengers were in the van. Troopers took a call on the crash just after 6 p.m. Others in the van were injured. A former Fairbanks chiropractor and gun dealer has been sentenced to 17 years in prison for soliciting the murder of federal officers and others involved in an investigation against him in a separate murder-for-hire plot. The Fairbanks Daily Newsminer reports that Guy Christopher Menino was sentenced Wednesday after being found guilty of trying to kill a witness and two federal officers while behind bars in 2014. Prosecutors say Menino tried to hire a fellow inmate to kill those involved in the investigation for a 2013 murder plot, which wasn't carried out and didn't result in charges. The inmate instead approached authorities and agreed to help gather evidence against Menino. Menino's attorney had sought a shorter prison term, citing his 57-year-old client's age and poor health. Bethel Senior Center is closing its doors to seniors. ONC runs the program and will keep many of its services, but starting next month, it will no longer offer a space for seniors to gather, talk, and eat. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports seniors will remain fed and supported, but they could be spending a lot more time alone.
Are you usually the first one to arrive?
It seemed like it.
It's 9:30 in the morning at the ONC Senior Center. Albert Kowagli and I are waiting a half hour for the other elders to show up.
I'm 67, going on 68. Young man yet.
Albert's been coming to the center every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for 6 years. He says many of the elders grew up in Bethel and have known each other since childhood.
And so what will you miss most when this closes down?
My friends, you know, playing cards with my friends here. Instead of just watching the four walls that surround me.
The closure is happening July 1st. At that time, elders will no longer have a place to eat lunch, talk, and play bingo 3 days a week.
So what I fear that would be lost with this program is the risk for isolation and loneliness, and their primary care providers, the people that are taking care of them at home, I fear that it might increase the risk for burnout.
Program director Nikki Hoffman says ONC is closing the center to prevent a $200,000 budget deficit. The program mainly runs off state grants, but the funding problem isn't with the state's budget cuts. It's with the senior center itself, housed in the Lions Club building.
The grant award that we get for the adult day is $110,000. 75% of that would be used directly for the facility.
Three positions are also being cut. One of those, the program manager, is held by Denise Kanigak.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
The ONC bus has pulled up. and the elders, about 20, are walking in.
And so this is what they do. They usually come in, wash up, and then they head over here. Check out the birds, of course. Whenever we get new food donations, they're always quick to go check what we have so they know it's in stock.
The birds are about a dozen ducks and geese lying on a table. Subsistence donations that will be taken home and used in future lunches.
Good morning, Elena.
The elders move to different parts of the room. Most get a snack. Some start a game of rummy or begin quilting. Others watch Jeopardy. I approach one elder eating a pastry and wearing a big red sun hat.
Catherine Peters, and I'm 82 or the 83. Or am I 83?
Catherine says she lives with her son, who works during the day. She can't cook or leave the house by herself. All this, she says, makes the senior center so important.
Sometimes we're lonesome at home. Our families are, you know, they can't be all the time with us in the home. I'll miss talking to my friends, people here. Even if I can't see or hear, they come to me. And that makes me just happy and make my day cheerful.
ONC Senior Services will still deliver a meal to 50 seniors around Bethel Monday through Friday. And ONC will still drive seniors to the post office, bank, and grocery stores. But that route will happen once instead of three times a week. They'll also continue helping elders with paperwork, like paying bills and requesting prescription refills. After group exercises with a physical therapist and then a lunch of barbecue chicken and green beans, the elders settle in for what I'm told is their favorite activity.
Are you guys ready? Large X, G57.
ONC's long-term goal is to build a senior center of its own and give its elders a place to gather and eat throughout the week. As of now, there's no set plans for making that happen. At the Senior Center in Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
I, 25. Bingo.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Emily Russell in Nome, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future that delivers oil today and sustains operations for tomorrow.
The University of Alaska Southeast specializes in you. UAS is a learning community where your professors or mentors and friends on campus and online. UAS.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. The Resource Basket is a training and technical assistance center helping rural communities support healthy, resilient, and culturally connected youth. Tribes and youth-serving organizations can request support, explore resources, and find opportunities at resourcebasket.org or call the team directly at 1-800-478-7227, extension 7396. This message sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.